Good morning. Thanks for attending on this lovely election day. So I'm going to present some validations comparing simulated and observed model outputs with the Descent model with our irrigated cornfields in Colorado. And Descent, as probably most of you know, is the daily version of the Century model, originally developed by Bill Parton and others back in the 70s. And then Descent was released in the late 90s. And then I got my master's and PhD working for Bill and really helped with the trace gas submodel for Descent. So, and that was one of the main reasons Descent was developed. So Century runs on a monthly time step, meaning uses monthly mean temperature and precipitation inputs. And you can do a decent job predicting crop yields and long-term changes in soil carbon with that kind of time step. But with the interest in greenhouse gas emissions and climate change, there was a need to simulate nitrous oxide and methane fluxes. And you can't get away with the monthly time step. Because as you know, you get this big rainfall event, you could get 80 or 90% of your N2O emissions for the month in a 1 or 2 day period. So just using the monthly mean isn't going to cut it. And then Jorge Delgado was very instrumental in running the field experiment that we're going to look at and collecting the different types of data. The other thing that emphasizes this modeling effort really relies on major collaboration between USDA ARS and the Ecology Lab at Colorado State University. So many programmers, many scientists have put a lot of work, and so this what I'm going to show, I only have 3 co-authors, but it's really many more people really contributed to this. I don't think I have an outline slides, so I'll just say it. We'll go over the major submodels in Descent, some of the major applications that the model is currently used for, and then look at what we're doing, what we're manipulating and measuring in the field experiment. But then the majority of the slides will be the simulated versus observed, so you get an idea of how well the model is performing at this site. So Descent, this is the famous flow diagram. It does MPP on a daily time scale and divides that fixed carbon and nitrogen among different plant components. So that's all plant-specific parameters, determine what portion of MPP is going to leaves, roots, etc. Then plant material senesces and dies, gets into the dead pool, structural and metabolic, driven by carbon to nitrogen ratios. So the structural is more the lignin, the hard, more difficult for the microbes to decompose. The metabolic has more nitrogen, easier for the microbes to decompose. Then after that first step of decomposition, it's not dead plant material anymore. Then it goes into the soil organic matter pools. It's just active, slow, and passive with different inherent decomposition rates. And soil texture helps determine how much goes into the passive. The model assumes as clay content goes up, you're going to have more of that protected carbon, so more is going to go into the passive. And, of course, the model does water and temperature by layer, and that's controlling all these processes. As the soil organic matter decomposes, you give off CO2, but you also mineralize ammonium and nitrate. And, of course, you could also have inputs from fertilizer or fixation feeding those soil pools. And so the model does nitrate throughout the profile. And we have a sort of recommended default soil profile, but the user can change this. You can make those layers as thick or as thin as you want. You can go all the way down the bedrock, only go down to whatever soil depth you're working with. And one limitation is currently it only does ammonium in the top 15 centimeters. So unlike nitrate, it assumes that ammonium is not mobile at all. Now, certainly ammonium is less mobile than nitrate, but I think it does move. So that's a model improvement we'll be looking at in the future, is to do more realistic representation of ammonium throughout the profile. And then the big ones, nitrification and denitrification leading to the nitrogen gas emissions, so NOx N2O. And you just get into that a little bit. So the nitrification, that's driven by the ammonium in the soil, the temperature, and the water content. So the model assumes about 50% water content. You're going to have your maximum nitrification rates. As you get wetter or drier, that's going to tail off. And then denitrification, obviously driven by the nitrate in the soil and the water content. And the model assumes you're not going to get denitrification until you get to, say, about 80, 90% water-filled pore space if you're a sandy soil. But if you're a clay soil, the model assumes that you could have these micro pockets that could be anaerobic, even though you might be only 55, 60% water-filled pore space, especially if there's a lot of respiration going on. If the oxygen demand is high due to respiration, you could get these anaerobic microsites, even though you're far from saturation, and get some denitrification going on. And then methane, we've had methane uptake in the upland, you know, non-saturated soils. That's been in the model for about, yeah, at least 10 years. We recently added a version of the model that does methane production in the saturated rice systems. Okay, and some of the current applications, our biggest thing is the greenhouse gas inventory. On the left is the cover for the EPA inventory. So every year, compiled by the EPA and turned into the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. So our group is responsible for estimating the soil greenhouse gas fluxes for this report. So we have to report to the UN based on economic sector. We're in charge of the ag sector, particularly the soil emissions is what we use DASENT for. And then we also have the USDA greenhouse gas inventory, and that was the latest edition of that just came out a couple of months ago, and it's consistent with the EPA inventory, but things are partitioned further. So in the EPA, it's mostly national totals and some state-level emissions, but and it's not broken down by cropping system very much. But in the USDA inventory, we break it down to the MLRA level, and there's hundreds of MLRA. You know, there's more MLRAs in the country than there are states, so it's finer spatial resolution. And then we also break down the emissions by cropping systems, to say small grains, alfalfa systems, hay systems. There's about 8 or 10 different categories where we break, you know, partition out the emissions. So if you're doing life cycle analysis, you can get that data from the USDA report. Now, the other thing that's cool about that, the USDA report, is the data that goes into all the tables and figures and maps in that report can be downloaded. They're all in CSV files, so it's easy to download. If you want to analyze and, you know, run with that data, you're free to do that. Another application I don't have here, the models have been used fairly extensive for, is integrated with other methods to do life cycle analysis of greenhouse gas emissions from different biofuel cropping systems, so comparing fossil fuels versus switchgrass or corn grain ethanol. That's another application we got a fair amount of publications on. And then just in general, the inventory in the U.S., we estimate agricultural sectors about 8% of the emissions or so. So it's not a huge source, but not insignificant. But on the global scale, agriculture is closer to 25% or so. And I think a lot of that's due to the deforestation on the global scale, all that carbon that's being lost from trees that are being converted into pasture land and cropland. In the U.S., if anything, we're reforesting. We have a lot of former cropland in the eastern half of the country in particular that now is expanding tree biomass and actually fixing a fair amount of carbon. So this is the overview of our experimental site in Colorado. Our plots are the smaller ones where you can see the different shades of greens. This makes it pretty obvious that we're doing fertilizer rate experiments. You can see the light green versus the dark green. So we have about 5 or 6 different nitrogen rates. And this is actually land owned by Colorado State University, but parcels are turned over to USDA to manage. So the whole experimental site, I'm only showing maybe about 1/10 of it, is pretty huge, many, many acres. But those plots there are our USDA experiment. And what are we looking at? So we're in those different plots. As I said, we're obviously varying the nitrogen source and rate. So different types of fertilizers, manure versus synthetic, different crop rotations, different tillage intensity, residue management. We've taken away residue versus residue retention in some of the plots. And some of those plots go back to 1999. They've had the same management. So it's good to have this long-term consistent, so you can see sometimes you measure things 2 or 3 years, you get one answer, but 10 or 15 years later, your answer can change, and we've seen that, so we think it's important to keep these fields maintained for the long term. And then the main things we're measuring are trace gas fluxes, grain yields, soil water, carbon, and nitrogen. And there's some of the guys doing some greenhouse gas emissions. So we measure the methane, the CO2, and the N2O. We're going to concentrate on the N2O. And we also started measuring the ammonia emissions. That's a different apparatus. I don't have it in that photo. But that's good data to have as well, because the ammonia can be a significant loss vector. So now we're going to get into the validations, just simulated versus observed. So this is XY graph. One of the first things we look at is the grain yields. If your model isn't getting the plant growth correctly, then you're not going to have a good chance of getting N2O or soil carbon changes or anything else. So this is the NT is no-till versus the conventional corn fields and those different nitrogen rates. So the model's doing pretty decent. You're getting R-squares of 65% to 70%. And the other thing I should say is, like I said, we use the model for that greenhouse gas inventory. We run it across the country. So this is the inventory version of the model. It's meant to be a general model. So the model hasn't been tuned at all for these validations. We're just using the off-the-shelf, all the default parameters, so no effort to do any tuning. And here's a similar figure, but it's showing the average yields for these different treatments over however many years of data we have, and some of these bars are representing more than 10 years. So CT and NT, conventional till and no-till, and then the numbers are just the amount of fertilizer in grams per square meter. So going from 0 to 20 grams per square meter or 200 kilos per hectare. And you see the model's getting, the trend's pretty well. As fertilizer goes up, your yields go up. The no-till yields tend to be a little bit lower, both the simulated and observed. What the model's screwing up here is the zero additions, especially with the no-till, and SC is the soy-corn rotation. So when you don't add any fertilizer, the model's under-predicting the yields. And it's actually hard to explain why the observations, some of those fields have been zero nitrogen additions for a dozen years or more, and you're still getting fairly decent yields. So I think you can understand what, from the model's perspective, as time goes on, if you're not adding any nitrogen and you're taking away 100 kilos every year with your grain harvest, the model assumes things are draining down and your yields are going down. But the observations, the zero treatments, that they're not going down that much with time. So there's some mysterious nitrogen apparently coming out of somewhere that's maintaining those zero addition treatments. And we can't really explain it. So that is kind of a common theme. It's almost always easy to explain model behavior, but the real world is more complex, as we know. It gets more mysterious. So now similar figures with nitrous oxide addition. Similar to that first grain yield one, so similar versus observed. And these are the treatments, the annual means for those different treatments, different fertilizer levels. We're getting an R-squared of about 50%, which isn't too bad. N2O is more difficult than crop yields. If we get R-squares of close to 50% or more, we're typically happy with trace gas fluxes. But again, these are the annuals. They're not the daily. We'll see that in a minute here. So the R-square looks pretty good, but if you look at the slope and the intercept, 1.2 and 5, the model's overestimating. In the next slide, makes it more clear how badly the model is overestimating. So it's the same conventional till, no-till, soy corn, the different fertilizer levels. So I think the main points here, the model's getting the general patterns. just like grain yields, if you add more fertilizer, your N2O is going to increase. And the N2O tends to be a little bit lower with the no-till compared to the conventional till for a given amount of fertilizer. So it's getting a real good job getting those patterns. It just has this really bad overestimation, especially when you're adding fertilizer. Here with the zero, the model's biased high, but it's not so bad. But you look at those 130 kilos per hectare, 200 kilos per hectare, the model is overestimating by a factor of two or more than that in some cases. But again, keep in mind, this wasn't tuned at all. We could certainly, there's a knob we could turn to make this come out right on the money, but like I said, this is just the off-the-shelf default parameters. So it just begs the question, why is the model overestimating so much? And it's the same pattern for all the treatments. I'm just going to show you the conventional till with high nitrogen. So these are the daily nitrous oxide fluxes. So I think as somebody said before, the blue line continuous because the model gives you a number every day. The measurements are only two or three times a week, so we use the dots for the measurements. And you get that big pulse both simulated and observed early in the growing seasons after you add your fertilizer. That makes sense. But the interesting thing is the red dots, the measurements, they come down the background within about a month, month and a half after you've added that fertilizer. Versus the model, it's coming down, but it's not coming down near as quickly as the measurement. And the reason for this, again, it's easy to explain from the model perspective. You get out into July and August, your fertilizer has been pretty much used up by the crop and by the other losses, but you're mineralizing nitrogen because it's warm. Colorado, July, August, it's still warm, and we're irrigating once a week. So you're still mineralizing a lot of nitrogen, so that's why the model is showing some nitrification and why that blue line doesn't come down near as fast as the observation. So another way of saying that, it seems that the microbes in that soil, in that system, they only respond to new N. You add your fertilizer, you get these pulse, it only lasts 30, 40, 45 days or so, and then it comes back down the background. But the old nitrogen that's been recycled and is freshly mineralized, the model says, yeah, that's eligible to be nitrified and denitrified, but the observation just is not showing that. So these are the model improvements that we're currently working on. One is more mechanistic plant growth. Right now, there's this parameter in the model called PRDX, and it's crop-specific, and it really sets the maximum potential growth rate for a particular crop. So we're trying to do that more mechanistically, so it's more driven by radiation and leaf area index, and not having a full-blown photosynthesis model, but just at least having a more mechanistic plant growth model. Another one is ammonia volatilization. Right now, when you add fertilizer, if you do surface application, depending on the precip dynamics, you can lose a lot to volatilization within that first week or so before it even has a chance to get into the soil. That's not in the model at all. In fact, you can't even really do a surface application. When you add fertilizer in the model, it assumes that it's evenly distributed in that top 15 centimeters right away. So you can't even. So we're trying to do more realistic fertilizer application so you can distinguish between a surface application versus a banded application, and that goes along with this ammonia volatilization. If you're doing the surface application, then you're vulnerable to that. So having that in the model could really help, because sometimes you could be losing 10-20% or more of your nitrogen right from the get-go, but right now we're assuming it all gets into the soil, so that could maybe help explain some of those overestimations of the N2O. This nitrification N2O portion, what we mean by that is what, the vast majority of the ammonium that's nitrified gets converted to nitrate. Only about a percent or so gets converted to N2O. And I think the number we're using in the model now is 1.2%, and we're assuming that that's constant. And so this is what the point I said with that bar graph, where the model is overestimating the N2O so bad, all we would have to do is make that 1.2% be 0.6%, then it would cut those simulated bars in half, and they would match the observation very well. And we tried that, but then when we go to other sites and we try to use that same 0.6%, then you end up underestimating. So the 1.2 that we're using now sort of works across sites, sort of does the mean. But maybe it should be variable. I think there's some evidence if you're wetter and you have nitrification, a higher portion of the nitrified N is going to be lost as N2O versus if you're drying. So trying to get the gas diffusivity or oxygen, I think it really comes down to there's maybe some oxygen control on the portion of nitrified N that gets lost as N2O. So we have a couple of papers on that. There's some laboratory experiments. So if we could get that in the model and have that be dynamic in a logical way, that could really help our N2O emissions. And then this other thing that's really uncertain is the denitrification N2 to N2O ratio. And a lot of models do it this way. You know, they calculate total denitrification, so the N2 plus N2O together, and then you divvy that up, you partition that between N2 and N2O. And we base it on, again, it's this gas diffusivity water content thing. The model assumes as things get wetter, as the gas diffusivity goes down, as oxygen becomes less available, you're going to have more N2 in proportion to N2O. But maybe there's other factors that control that ratio that we don't have in the model that could be in there. And again, this is a tuning knob. It's one of those, you can manually adjust what we have this dynamic N2 to N2O ratio, but you can adjust what the maximum N2 to N2O ratio is. So I think our recommended default is the maximum ratio is about 25 or 30. But there's some experiments that ratio can be up to 100 or so. And so it's another tuning knob. You can adjust that N2 to N2O ratio and make the model match the data in any particular site. But again, you get into trouble, then you go across sites and it's not going to work. So if we could have some logical way to adjust that maximum ratio or to account for other factors that are impacting on that ratio, that could potentially help very much. That's it. And I'd be, if people have suggestions or, you know, any research to help with these kind of questions. You know, the other thing is there's always this trade-off. You want to improve your model, which often involves making it more complex. But if you make it too complex, then you can't run the model. There's some very complex models. I'm thinking like EcoSys, if anybody's heard of that, from Canada. And it's got everything, and it's got the microbial biomass and phase transitions and solutes, and it does nitrifiers and denitrifiers. So I think we can learn a lot from those types of models. But in our case, we want to be able to keep doing the National Greenhouse Gas Inventory where we run the model across the country. So when you want to do these really large-scale simulations, if you make your model too complex, then you can never get the inputs required that you can on a site level. So there's always that trade-off. But if we can get some extra complexity in the model but without having to require a lot more model inputs, then that's what we're looking for. I didn't say that with the model, but it's just like the other models we've heard today. The inputs are pretty simple. You just need your crop management, you need a daily weather file, and you need to know your soil type. So it's really just three types of inputs, and we typically know those inputs very well for just about anywhere in the U.S. So we don't want to go too much beyond those inputs. But if we can add some complexity and get some improvement, that's what we're looking for. Thank you.